This hour of the program presented by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. More information, visit prescription-center.com. And New Hampshire Primary Interviews on the New Hampshire Now program, presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire. More information, check out rathlaw.com.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I want to get on 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College and interviews on the campaign trail brought to you by New Futures. In just a moment, we're joined by entrepreneur, successful businessman, and author Andrew Yang, who has been able to generate a lot of excitement amongst grassroots supporters with a number of his plans, including the annual income of $12,000 that he gives to Americans on a monthly basis, $1,000 per month. And he is one of those candidates that has a tremendous kind of underground support. Yeah. And we're going to bring him above ground here to Pints of Politics as we're joined by Dean Spildes. Dean, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing well, Chris, and I'm excited to meet him. He's somebody who's been hard at work in this state for a long time.
Yeah.
He's been pretty visible and gotten a lot of attention with this guaranteed minimum income of $1,000 a month. And so I'm sure we'll talk about that. But I'm interested to hear about a number of his other policy interests. And, you know, he's, as you said, he has kind of a grassroots following here. People ask about him a lot. As I said, he's highly visible. He's doing better than some major U.S. Senate candidates.
He's going to be on the debate stage.
He's going to be on the debate stage, as is Marion Williamson, which will also be interesting. So, yeah, I'm very eager to talk with him a bit and get a closer look at his economic philosophy, which is getting a lot of attention around the country.
Yeah, he first started to come to the Granite State last year with his book, The War on Ordinary People, and came into the Concord Photo Service Main Street Studio a couple times for that. So, yeah, I'm interested to talk with him again. And, you know, he is one of those outsider-type candidates in a field that doesn't really have as many of the outsider candidates as we thought they would. A lot of individuals who have held elected office. The only two who have not, Andrew Yang and, as you referenced, Marianne Williamson.
Yeah. Well, the guaranteed income is something, whether you like it or not, that has given him a way to differentiate from the mass of other candidates. So in a way, it's getting him attention that a number of the other Senate and House, U.S. House candidates aren't getting because they all are just kind of undifferentiated and clumped together. So he's a little bit unique in that respect, and I think he's using it to his best advantage at the moment.
All right, this is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. When we return, we'll be joined by noted author, entrepreneur, and businessman Andrew Yang, Democratic presidential candidate, Pints of Politics, presented by New England College, and interviews on the campaign trail brought to you by New Futures. This hour of the program presented by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. More information, visit prescription-center.com. And New Hampshire Primary Interviews on the New Hampshire Now program, presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire. More information, check out rathlaw.com.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I am Chris Ryan. Pints of Politics presented by New England College. Interviews out on the campaign trail, presented by New Futures. We're going to be joined on the program today here at the Barley House by Andrew Yang, successful businessman, author, an entrepreneur, and he comes to the Granite State with a significant amount of momentum. I hear a lot about Andrew Yang as a Democratic candidate for president, most frequently from individuals who aren't necessarily engaged in the political process, and you have seen a significant amount of swelling support, big audiences, and you're going to be on the debate stage. Andrew, great to see you.
Great to see you, Chris. Great to be back in New Hampshire. Love it here.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, how you feel right now and why you think that your candidacy is resonating, particularly amongst, you know, average Americans who are looking for something different.
Well, the facts show that about 25% of Americans are what's called politically disengaged. Mm-hmm. And that's even true here in New Hampshire, where a lot of people don't feel like politics directly affects their day-to-day lives. And I'm laser focused on solving the problems that got Donald Trump elected, all the frustration we've had with our government over the last number of years, where our economy is changing in fundamental ways. 30% of Main Street stores are closing. Our cars and trucks are on the verge of driving themselves. And our politicians are decades behind the times. So when people find out about me and the campaign and my flagship proposal, putting a $1,000 dividend in the hands of every American adult starting at age 18, they think to themselves, wow, that would actually improve my life in concrete and direct ways. And Andrew's talking about things that matter to me.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the big keys, and we're going to get into that proposal in a second. But for a lot of other politically savvy folks, the folks that pay attention to this on a day-in-day-out basis, they're thinking about, you know, the senators and the congressmen and Vice President Biden. And for them, your name is a new one. So give us a little bit of an upshot as to why you're doing this and what is driving that decision, and what about your experience would allow for you to be a successful president?
So I spent the last 7 years building an organization that I had started, Venture for America, that helped create several thousand jobs in Detroit, Cleveland, Birmingham, St. Louis, and other cities around the country. And it was there that I realized that the transformation of our economy is the most profound we've ever seen, what experts are calling the fourth industrial revolution, where the most common jobs in the United States are disappearing. And those jobs are administrative and clerical work, retail and sales, food service and food preparation, truck driving and transportation and manufacturing. Those are the five most common job categories in the United States. And their continued disappearance is what brought Donald Trump to power. And so the reason I'm running for president is because I'm laser focused on solving the real problems of the 21st century and helping move us forward. I have a positive vision that would actually enable millions of Americans to share in the gains of these innovations and also feel good about our shared future.
Go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, Andrew, let me ask you a fairly specific question. I heard you interviewed on another radio show, and you made a really interesting comment about job training. And I bring this up because here in New Hampshire, we've had a big debate for a number of years between Democrats and Republicans over job training. Democrats in the state legislature want to commit a much more significant portion of state funds for job training in the new economy that you've talked about. Republicans would prefer to give tax cuts to private industry and let private industry handle job training. And if I understood correctly what you were saying on the other show, you said something like, well, rather than spend that money on you know, state-sponsored or business-sponsored job training, give the individuals the money themselves to use in other ways. So I just wanted you to kind of expand on that a little bit. I haven't heard anybody say that before, and it's been a big debate here in the state for a while.
Oh, I love the question. So I've looked at different job training programs around the country. And the most successful ones are when you start with the job and then you're trying to train someone to fill that job because you know the job's there. The training doesn't work when you train people and you hope that the job's waiting for them. Now, if you have two choices, invest in job training or tax cuts for businesses, I don't think the tax cuts for businesses would necessarily lead to the job growth that some people would expect. Because as someone who's run a company, your incentives are less and less to hire lots and lots more people. And it's more and more to streamline your operations and to try and operate as cost efficiently as possible. And like it or not, people are sometimes not the most cost efficient ways to get things done. So we should be investing in job training, but we should also be realistic about situations where it will and won't be effective. And the best way to determine whether it'll be effective is if you have the employers standing there saying, I will hire this many people if you can get them this form of training, and then you invest in that. And if that's not there, then you don't talk yourself into it.
But on the Democratic side of the ledger, so Democrats in the state have proposed a significant infusion of money into, you know, retraining workers in technology and you know, to help deal with automation. You're okay with that, provided that the jobs are there, or would you use the money in other ways?
So to your earlier question, I do prefer it when the money gets put just directly into the hands of the American people and the workers themselves. Rather than the government pretending that we can figure out how best to deploy you, it's better to put the money in your hands and help make you more able to make adjustments. Because whatever the government comes up with is not going to be the right fit for a lot of people. It's not going to work for a lot of people. Whereas the money in their hands will almost universally make that household or individual or family better equipped to make their own adjustment.
One of the reasons that I think people like this proposal, and we'll debate the, you know, the merits, the execution and such, as I'm sure you do pretty much on a regular basis in regards to the plan. But one of the things I think people like about it is that it is direct. And other political figures will say, well, we're going to do this. We're going to have we're going to forgive debt. We're going to have student debt forgiveness. We're going to have free college. But I think that it is, and I want to hear from you, Is it your fundamental belief that the way that the economy is moving forward, that there's going to have to be redistribution of wealth because of the where jobs are going, the fact we see more individuals working part-time or multiple part-time jobs, and that if there is not this wealth redistribution in a direct fashion, that individuals are going to fall into a situation where it's perpetual poverty?
Well, it's clearly the case that putting money directly into your hands would be a bigger difference maker than my trying to run around and pay for something on your behalf, because you might not want the thing I'm paying for.
Mm-hmm.
And the most direct example of that is free college. It's like, do I think that public college should be less expensive for people? Yes, I do. But only 33% of Americans are going to attend college, so why am I subsidizing something that's only going to be enjoyed by essentially the top third of the population? What if someone's 49 years old and used to work as a truck driver and they actually have zero interest in going to mm-hmm. college? So it's much better to just put straight cash into people's hands than try and figure out what we can pay for that would make their lives better.
One of the arguments against this has been that this is un-American and that there should not be individuals given money for doing nothing, and that there should be some sort of incentive. And therefore, that's why couching it within free college, or couching it within tax incentives.
Or even why expanded Medicaid here in New Hampshire right. is tied to a set of job requirements.
Right.
Now.
So that just handing individuals $1,000 a month for nothing will create a culture of dependency, laziness, and there is no reason or rationale to do that.
Yeah, it's quite the opposite on both of those fronts. So first, it's a deeply American idea. Thomas Paine was for it at the founding of the country, called it the Citizens' Dividend. Martin Luther King was for it in the 60s, called it the Guaranteed Minimum Income. Milton Friedman and 1,000 economists said this would be tremendous for America. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, just came out last month for a negative income tax, was essentially just guaranteeing a certain amount of money for every American. And rather than foster dependence, it actually fosters independence. Because if you have $1,000 a month, you're better able to make your own choices, your own adjustments, and it will help you do the kind of work that you want to do. How many Americans would start a business or do something a bit different than they're doing if they knew that their basic needs were going to be met? This is the freedom dividend. It's a dividend on our incredible progress as a country. And rather than constrain people, it will set us free.
Just one more clarification here on this dividend. So, I've heard you talk about this elsewhere. Are there trade-offs in terms of the amount of money you receive in relation to other forms of federal support, like supplemental Social Security, maybe federal disability money, food stamps, Medicaid reimbursement? How does is $1,000 just you get $1,000 and none of the other stuff matters, or is there some sort of formula for what you if you take $1,000 you may not get all of your money somewhere else?
Yeah, so it's completely independent of healthcare, Medicaid, any of that. Like, that's a whole totally separate bucket. And the goal is not to take anything away from anyone, but it is to try and improve the bureaucratic structures of the current programs that we administer, so that if you choose to take the freedom dividend, then you would be foregoing cash and cash-like benefits from certain other programs, okay. which would decrease the enrollment in those programs over time. And it does end up making the incentives much more positive, because most of our current programs, if you start doing better, then you get less. Whereas with the dividend, if you do better, you get to keep that and you keep the dividend too.
Yeah.
So it actually aligns incentives, it reduces bureaucracy. But I don't want to take anything away from anyone if people are relying on it.
Now, you've talked about a value-added tax as a means of funding this, I believe. And that's an idea that other politicians and candidates have raised in the U.S. in the past. I know other countries have it, but it's been kind of a political loser here in the past. And I guess the question is, how do you make your best case for why we should move to something like a value-added tax? I know the idea is that, well, you're putting a tax on luxury goods and things like that, but people who oppose it argue that wealthy people have a much bigger saved income, so the burden really kind of falls on lower income level. So I'm just interested to hear your best case for it.
Well, I'm actually going to put it in terms that are specific to New Hampshire. That if you think that New Hampshire is going to be somehow the source of this money, then you're not looking up as to what the true repositories of wealth are. Amazon's a $1 trillion company that paid zero in taxes. Like, if we designed this correctly, Jeff Bezos would be a net payer of tens of billions of dollars. New Hampshire would get $8 billion plus. It would grow your consumer economy by more than 15%. It would create more than 20,000 jobs. I mean, $12,000 a year in a household with two adults is $24,000 a year. And then maybe, you know, your expenses go up like a tiny bit. But who in this state is spending like $250,000 a year like on anything? You know, so New Hampshire would be an enormous net winner. From this, we have to go where the money is. And you know, not a knock on anyone, but like that, you know, the money, like New Hampshire would be a massive net winner in this system.
But what about the taxation aspect of it, and people saying that the burden would actually fall on lower income people?
Well, it might if we weren't taking all of that money and then multiplying it several fold and then putting it in the hands of Americans. So if you just were to pass like a tax and not do anything else, then sure. But in this case, we're taking that money, multiplying it several times over and putting it directly into your hands. No government intermediary, just you've got the straight cash. And then we go to Jeff Bezos and the gang and get the money.
So right there, you explain why this is wildly popular amongst individuals. It's putting money into their pocket, and you're taking it from large corporations that individuals feel have, in a lot of ways, redistributed wealth to the top.
They've sucked New Hampshire dry.
Right.
I mean, you got to look up and say Amazon's soaking up $20 billion a year and closing 30% of your stores, and you're seeing zero. I mean, that's messed up.
And you look at the Walmarts of the world as well, and the effects that they have had on suburban communities. And I completely see the popularity element of it. So two things. First is implementation and how you would go about making this happen. How do you gain the type of support that is necessary as president to make this come to fruition?
So this is the joy of being in the state of New Hampshire. So I'm polling at 3% now, and we're going to shock the world. So if New Hampshire gets behind me and this plan and this vision for a trickle-up economy from people and families and communities up, let's say that I shock the world and win the presidency and I'm in the White House in 2021. Everyone will know exactly how that happened.
And why?
They'll be like, hey, it was the dividend. And I'll be like, heck right, it was a dividend. And Democrats would be super excited to work with a new Democratic president who beat Donald Trump and get this dividend into families' hands because it makes children and families stronger, healthier, mentally healthier, more productive. And then Republicans and conservatives will look up and say, wait a minute, this is a net transfer to rural areas and places that have been struggling with the aftermath of automation and a lot of states on the interior. And am I really going to stand in the way of my constituents and this dividend that a lot of them love? I mean, the state with a dividend right now is Alaska, which is a deep red state. This is not even a lefty idea. This is not left or right. It's forward. After I'm president, we can 100% make this dividend happen in Congress. And then the American people will look up shocked and say, wow, the government did something that actually helped that I love. And then maybe we can get some other things done, too.
Yeah, again, I think that the clear definition of this is what makes it so intriguing to so many individuals, where other candidates talk about redistribution of wealth, but in ways that aren't as direct. The final piece, though, is still kind of getting back to the money for nothing, quote unquote, aspect of things. Do you feel that perhaps it would be advantageous to tie it into some sort of service where individuals have to meet a certain threshold of AmeriCorps, community service, and that if you are going to be receiving this type of money, there's going to be this type of a give back to your church, to your community, to planting flowers, to whatever the case may be?
I love service. I started a service organization myself, and ran it for a number of years. But I do think that any requirement you put on would end up being onerous and not actually super productive. And then there'd be like a million different ways to kind of meet that requirement. That the American people don't need our government breathing down our neck, telling us how to spend our money. And this is our money. Some folks might disagree on this, but I think any requirement would end up having many more adverse effects than any gains.
That's Andrew Yang, Democratic candidate for president, joining us here on Pints of Politics at the Barley House, presented by New England College. Interviews on the campaign trail brought to you by New Futures. We'll come back and delve more into his plans as president of the United States after this. This hour of the program presented by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. For more information, visit prescription-center.com. And New Hampshire primary interviews on the New Hampshire Now program, presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire. For more information, check out rathlaw.com.
newhampshirenow.com.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
Welcome back. This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, 1-9-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. If you're joining us for the program, we're at the Barley House, Pints of Politics, presented by New England College, and interviews on the campaign trail brought to you by New Futures. So, very clearly, the first thing that you would do as President of the United States is introduce and ask Democrats to introduce legislation in regards to the freedom dividends. And that would be your focus. That would be your pretty much your entire focus. After that, what are the things that you want to accomplish?
Number 1A is we have to actually make our democracy work for the people of this country again. And the folks in New Hampshire, you all expect your votes to matter, but most of the country feels like their votes are getting drowned out by corporate money, where money has taken over our government. And they're largely right. And so the way we fix that is we put 100 democracy dollars in the hands of every American citizen that you can only give to political campaigns and candidates, and that would wash out the lobbyist money by a ratio of 5-1. And so if you have these democracy dollars, it's use it or lose it. If there's no one you like that year, you don't spend it. But then it makes it so that politicians don't have to chase the corporate money to fund their campaigns. They can actually go to the American people. And as someone who's been running for office for a little while, calling rich people for money is the most soul-crushing activity I can imagine. And so if you put the resources into Americans' hands through democracy dollars, $100 that all of us can spend on elections, then all of a sudden you'd see politicians that say, wait a minute, I can just represent the people and do good work.
Let's change topics a little bit and talk about the very important role of president as commander in chief. And I'd be interested to start the conversation to hear from you, given everything that's going on at the international level now with Iran and South Korea and Venezuela and ISIS, maybe top two foreign policy concerns of yours, and how would you address them in the short term?
Well, first, I think that our strength abroad is reflective of our strength at home. That if we're strong and prosperous here, then we can more reliably project a foreign policy agenda. And the reverse is true, too, that if we're disintegrating at home, which we have been, where our life expectancy has declined for the last 3 years because of surges in suicides and drug overdoses, and you wind up with a leader that other countries find erratic, then it's much harder to get things done. So my goal would be to rebuild our partnerships and alliances internationally and be more restrained and judicious. In terms of the paramount threats right now,
sure.
Nuclear proliferation would be one, cybersecurity would be two, and you could relate AI to that as well. And then I would put climate change as number three, which you don't really think of as a foreign policy crisis, but it's driving a lot of the foreign policy problems around the world, where climate change has set off migrant crises in various parts of the world that have actually changed the landscape politically.
So let's take nuclear proliferation, increasingly big issue on the foreign policy horizon. Right now, President Trump is dealing with the issue with North Korea. He's dealing with the issue with Iran, sort of two key questions of nuclear proliferation. When President Obama was president, he was criticized for potentially directly engaging the leadership in Iran and also in how he dealt with North Korea. How would you approach nuclear deterrence? Is it more sanctions, direct meetings with leaders, negotiations at the level of national security advisor? What would you do?
I think it's much more achievable to get things done if you engage with people. It's very hard to convince someone that it's in their self-interest to cooperate with you if you're not sitting down with them and talking to them. And so we have to look at it and make it in other countries' self-interest to not develop nuclear programs. If you're North Korea, you see your nuclear program as an instrument of your own regime survival, and that disarming would be equivalent to self-destruction. So how then do you change those incentives for that actor and say, look, actually, if you abandon your nuclear program, you're going to win from that? And then what can you do to make that a win for them? It's very hard to do that from across the world. You have to actually engage. And so to me, it's paramount to the American people that we just make ourselves safer. And whatever we need to do to get that done, we should be pursuing.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe in American, you know, supremacy, that, that our ideas, who we are as individuals, how we go about functioning?
Exceptionalism.
Supremacy.
Sorry, exceptionalism. Supremacy and exceptionalism. Do you believe in that, in that we are, we have a way of thinking, a philosophy, a foundation in governance that is superior to that of other countries?
Well, I'm the son of immigrants. I am so grateful to have been born in this country, because that's been the equivalent of winning a lottery ticket for people around the world for the last number of years. So we are the beneficiaries of a global world order that we helped establish. And to the extent that we can help maintain that world order without undue costs in American lives and treasure and resources, then we should pursue that. To the extent that we hold ourselves above other countries, I think that actually does have some hazards associated with it, and that we should not see the world as a zero-sum game where if someone else is getting more prosperous, then somehow it threatens us, which I think is the lens that you naturally take if you think that your exceptionalism applies across the world in every dimension.
What have you taken away from our negotiations with China, and what would you do differently?
There are very real grievances and imbalances in our relationship with China, particularly their piracy of intellectual property, which costs us tens of billions of dollars. I was just in Iowa, so politician-y. I was just in Iowa talking to a farmer there who was furious.
Because you're on vacation, right?
That he spent 6 years. I actually did bring my family with me this one. They were on spring break. And, you know, my family is, you know, trying to get time with daddy, which I appreciate a great deal.
So Aruba, California, Iowa. Let's go to Iowa as a family.
Yeah, that's what, that way yeah. It went down. As you can tell, I won the jackpot when I married my wife. A farmer in Iowa said to me that he spent 6 years building up a trade relationship for his crops in China that then got abandoned because of the tariffs, because mm-hmm. his crops were no longer cost competitive. Mm-hmm. And he said he had no idea if he'd ever get that relationship back, and he's furious. And so you have to look at the costs of the tariffs at the ground level for farmers and businesses and American workers. If there is any way to address the imbalances short of hurting American businesses and workers, like that would be the first choice. If you were going to impose these tariffs, you would want to give people tons of notice, because if you were this farmer, you've been investing for years in something you thought was going to pay off, and you did not have adequate notice that we're going to change the prices on you.
Are we getting to a place as a nation where we are going to be a purely consumption and technological based economy? And you mentioned farming, and
certainly a service economy as well.
Thinking
yeah.
in service economy, are we getting to a place where we're going to grow less and less, and we're going to make less and less, and we have to adjust to that, or do we try to create some equality in what we consume, how much time and energy we spend on entertainment, and what we make and grow as a nation?
Well, this also, just to piggyback on that question, this also speaks to the role of globalism, which is something that has been
right.
debated on and off in recent decades about, you know, a lot of these companies are global now, and the way we get our entertainment is global, and it's just a different time economically.
Yeah, so we have to start thinking differently about how we measure economic progress. So we're cheerleading GDP, and again, our life expectancy has declined for the last 3 years. First time in 100 years that's happened because of, again, suicides and drug overdoses. So how do you measure growth? And to me, we should be measuring growth in our health and life expectancy, our mental health and freedom from substance abuse, how our kids are doing, how clean our air and water are. And if you orient growth in those ways, then we can grow a great deal. But that's where we need to put our energies as fast as possible, because if we continue to prize GDP, which is a terribly flawed measurement that even the inventor said would be an awful measurement of well-being, we're going to lose on an epic scale. Because if you have self-driving trucks, that's going to be great for GDP, but it's going to be terrible for the 3.5 million truck drivers and the 7 million Americans who work at truck stops, motels, and diners that need people to get out of the trucks and have a meal. So with the wrong measurements, we'll never make progress. But if we have the right measurements, we can actually progress for quite some time because we have massive needs on the ground.
I should ask you, when you were in Iowa, did you get to go to the I-80 truck stop, the famous truck stop?
Yeah,
it's
man.
Pretty amazing. It's like a little city off the interstate.
I'm a regular there, Davenport,
okay,
Iowa.
Yeah, that's great.
I-80, 5,000 people stop there every
that's
day.
It's amazing.
When I go there, I get the orange Julius.
That's you got to do. That is Andrew Yang, candidate for president, joining us here for Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I was thinking as you're talking about the difference between how you speak and how a lot of the quote-unquote political figures in this race speak. And you know, Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren both laid out $100 billion plans to address the opioid epidemic as well as the mental health epidemic. I'm curious if you'll have differences in how you go about addressing issues of health and mental health as well. Where do you believe that a dividend is the way to address these issues, as opposed to an investment in programs?
Yeah, but I think, and you also think you support some phase in of Medicare for all, correct? Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, but to your point, Chris, both of you really like I obviously am for redoubling federal resources towards opiate addiction and mental health. I mean, those are big needs.
But
I would suggest that putting $1,000 a month into people's hands would lower stress levels and improve our mental health
right.
than any program I can come up with.
Right.
And similarly with opiate addiction, I'm for decriminalizing a personal use of opiates in the sense that if we catch you using opiates, we should refer you straight to treatment and out of jail cell. As long as you're not dealing, as long as you're not like profiting personally, if you're just struggling with addiction. So we should be investing in opiate addiction, but we also need to think bigger about what our priorities are. Are our priorities tossing people in jail, or are our priorities helping people get well?
I will say that's something that I've followed very closely in New Hampshire over the last 5 years, and the state is moving in that direction. There's been a pretty big infusion of federal funds, and the whole debate in the state has kind of shifted from law enforcement to help in recovery. And so I think the state is moving in that direction, but I understand your bigger point about decriminalizing it.
Well, you all unfortunately have learned the hardest way possible through tragedy and death, because I know New Hampshire has been struggling with opiate addiction at a higher level than most of the other states. And so we need to take the lessons that you all are learning and translate them to other parts of the country as fast as possible.
But what I'm getting at a little bit more in regards to this is, but do you feel that your philosophy in dealing with other issues is to be direct in regards to putting money into the hands of individuals? And a Medicare for All type of solution would obviously do that to a large extent. But do we need to rethink healthcare and to give more empowerment to the individual, similarly to what you're describing in regards to the Freedom Dividends account and also in addressing campaign finance issues? And is there a way to deal with healthcare that is because both sides have mentioned that healthcare is kind of the third rail of politics. You grab it, you own it, and there's a problem that's going to exist as a result of that. So is there something that you see with healthcare that political figures and other figures are missing, and that is a more direct, easy way to address this, similar to how you've ascribed in dealing with wealth redistribution?
Well, thank you for the question, Chris, because it suggests that I have like a different framework for solving these problems.
Though. I think that's a fair assertion.
Oh, and I mean, I love the question. All right, so I've dug into the mechanics of the healthcare market, and unfortunately, it does not operate the way other consumer markets
Correct.
Operate. Because you don't understand the pricing very often. You're cost insensitive if it's a serious problem. Sometimes you're in an altered state of consciousness because you're sick or injured. Mm-hmm. So this is not a circumstance where if I put money into your hands, then everyone's going to be able to negotiate it and sort it
right.
out.
Right, so you have to reform the system
right.
first.
Sure.
So
right.
the way that you reform the system itself is that one joke I tell is I'm Asian, so I have a lot of doctor friends. And what they'll tell you, if you get a couple beers in them, is that they've become revenue drivers themselves, where mm-hmm. the more they do, the more patients they see, the more money they make. That's where their financial incentives are. Now, if you have something like the Cleveland Clinic, where they get paid a stable amount no matter what, then what do you see? Mm-hmm. Shockingly, they prescribe procedures at lower levels because they say, hey, maybe you don't need this. Like they start ordering tests at lower levels because maybe you don't need this. And so if we can change healthcare providers' incentives so they're not getting paid based upon doing more and more stuff, mm-hmm. which drives up costs, and some of those things may or may not actually be vital for
A doctor from being a very well-paid state employee, from being a sort of the potential to get quite wealthy, actually, to being kind of a well-paid state employee at about 150 grand or 175 grand. I mean, that's a very different way of thinking about income.
Yeah, I have many friends who became doctors, and most of them did not seem to be motivated by great wealth. Now, that changed when they got into med school, because then we loaded them up with 200K. Yeah, then we loaded them up with 200K in debt, and then they said, hey, the more you specialize, the more money you make. And, oh, by the way, try not to go to a rural area because you get paid less. So then you have an undersupply of primary care doctors in rural areas around the country, and you have primary care deserts. So it would not be necessarily like the worst thing in the world if you had more doctors joining the field who genuinely wanted to help patients, make people healthier, knew they would lead a very comfortable, secure life, the envy of most every American family, but they're not going to have a yacht or, you know, just like run around, you know, making hundreds of thousands or even millions, you know, 3 days a week. And I'm going to suggest that most Americans would be fine with that, too.
I think you can keep a significant amount of wealth within the system, but also change it so that it is not a system that is based purely on encounters. In other words, having a more flat rate distribution amongst care providers, as opposed to an environment right now which is based purely upon encounters.
There's going to be plenty of money in the system, but one of the trade-offs should be is like, look, if we want you to do this good work, maybe in an area that's not going to like make you a major bank all the time, maybe we should make it so you don't owe $200,000 from the get when you come out.
Right.
Maybe that might actually change your specialization choices.
Would Medicare for All cover eventually over time, I think I've heard you say 5 to 10 years, over time for all Americans, or would there still be a private market for employers?
So it would cover all Americans, but private employers would have supplemental insurance available for employees if that's what they wanted. And this is similar to the system they have in Germany, where the public healthcare system covers everyone, but you do have private employers supplementing it in various cases.
Got it.
That is Andrew Yang, Democratic candidate for president. Join us here for Pints of Politics at the Barley House, presented by New England College, and interviews on the campaign trail brought to you by New Futures. A couple more things before we let you go. There's obviously a lot of focus in regards to President Trump, what's going to happen in the U.S. House of Representatives in regards to impeachment. And there's a very good chance that once the legal process or impeachment process either happens or doesn't happen, that the next president of the United States is going to have to make decisions about prosecution of the president and members of his staff and potentially his family. What is your mindset in regards to taking the presidency and either letting the past be the past or holding the president accountable? Will you hold his feet to
fire?
And
there's a great example of this from 2008. A lot of Democrats were clamoring for President Obama to allow the Justice Department to prosecute Trump administration members for war crimes. Remember that?
Bush administration.
Bush administration. And Obama said, no, we got to move on. We got to move forward.
So would you want to move on and move forward with bringing a country together? Or do you see what has taken place already, or what you believe may have taken place, as significant enough to hold the president accountable and have your attorney general do such?
No, I'm laser focused on solving the problems I got Donald Trump elected and beating him at the ballot box. I would have very, very low interest in dividing the country further by following up on things that had happened previously. I think the example that's been set by previous administrations in terms of not just not prosecuting, but in some cases even pardoning people that came before, set a very positive example where the United States should not be at a point where we have political leaders prosecuting past political leaders. That's happened in other countries, and I dare say it has been a disaster in those environments.
Final thing, debate stage. This is an opportunity for individuals like yourself to become known and to have that moment where you become a significant figure in this race. How do you go about doing that? Do you talk about the Freedom Dividends program? Do you highlight your bio? Do you go after other candidates? What's the strategy for maximizing those moments?
I have already memorized 3 zingers. No, I'm kidding.
while I was speaking.
Got your nicknames ready?
No. I mean, I joke about that because it's so painful when you can tell that they've memorized something that they hope, like, catches fire, goes viral. It's just, you know, I'm going to do the same thing I've been doing, which is answering questions and talking straight with the American people. I'm going to be thrilled to be on that debate stage because most Americans will just be tuning in at that point, and they're going to look me up and say, like, you know, who was that? So I just need to keep on trying to solve the problems of the American people and not get caught up in, you know, maximal use of airtime.
Do you find yourself having, you know, fundamental disagreements with how the political figures who you're running against want to solve problems? And is that a driving factor for you? Or do you think these are all good people, we have similar ideas, mine are a little better? How do you do you go about trying to differentiate yourself from folks on policy and vision?
I have liked most all of the other presidential candidates I have met on the trail. And I'm happy to say, if you run for president, you end up meeting most of them in New Hampshire, actually, or Iowa, or wherever. We go to the same events. They're, for the most part, earnest, patriotic, trying to do the right thing.
So who are the ones you don't like? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, seriously. Except for that one guy who clearly does not. No, I'm kidding.
He has a Brooklyn accent. I don't know. He just did.
I do think I have a fundamentally different vision as to how we can improve the lives of millions of Americans quite quickly. You know, and in my vision, putting economic resources and straight cash into people's hands would be the best way to improve your lives quite quickly. Better than just about any government program that one can devise or imagine. Because I believe I have a realistic sense of the limitations of our government. I mean, our government is excellent at very few things. And there are it's excellent at sending large numbers of checks to large numbers, not large numbers of Americans, promptly and reliably. That's one of its core competencies. We should lean into it. But some of my competitors seem to have relatively, let's say, aggressive or ambitious views of what the government can accomplish effectively in a reasonable time frame.
Well, Andrew, really appreciate your time. Look forward to talking to you again soon, and best of luck. Enjoy your time here in Hampshire.
Thank you, guys. Always great to be here, and I'll be here all the time.
That's Andrew Yang joining us for Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I'm Chris Ryan, along with Dean Spotis. We'll come back and wrap things up after this Pints of Politics presented by New England College. This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. 1-9, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College. Welcome back, Dean Spildes, as we recap Andrew Yang's appearance here. And very strong appearance. Yeah. And, you know, as we talked about before, his plan cuts out the middleman. And people are going to like that. People are fed up with government, and they see vast bureaucratic programs as not necessarily benefiting them. This is a program that he's pushing forth that, whether or not it's achievable, we can talk about that in a second, but he's pushing forth a plan that is easy to understand and has a, and individuals can see a direct benefit to them.
Yeah, he's certainly caught voters' interest with this. He can explain it in a very clear fashion. He doesn't back down from people's questions about you know, the federal government guaranteeing an income, as we saw with some of your questions. He's really thought this through, and the question is going to be how far he can take it. You know, I tried to focus a little bit on foreign policy. Every time I hear him, he's mainly talking about the economic issues, which obviously are the top issues for individuals. And so I think this was a good introduction to listeners of kind of where he's coming from economically, and I think he's going to continue to get attention in a very crowded field because of his ability to convey this in a very straightforward way to voters.
And since it is his not singular priority, but a priority that sits above everything else,
he seems comfortable letting it kind of drive his presentations.
Do you believe, as he said, he is going to have, if he's elected president of the United States and comes out of nowhere, nobody knew who he was, and then is elected president based upon the premise of this argument, he is going to have a much greater chance of succeeding in making this come to fruition. Now,
possibly depends on the obviously the composition of Congress, as we know.
I said chance of succeeding.
That could really slow you down, as we know.
So, again, I wouldn't bet on you getting $1,000 a month, but I think that you know, the singular focus helps. I mean, if you're a presidential candidate and you've got 10 different things that you want to accomplish.
Right.
That's harder to accomplish the one. If you have the one and that's your focus, there's a chance of success.
And the big difference is that, you know, that we're talking about a different way of transferring funds from government to individuals. Typically, that involves a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of challenges for individuals. The simplicity, I think, is what people like about the simplicity and the kind of ability to decide for yourself how and when you use it. I think people are drawn to that.
No strings attached. Individuals feel that there's been a concentration of wealth with companies that should be doing more, and this is a way to put that wealth directly into your pocket. Dean, as always, appreciate you joining us for the program.
Sure thing, Chris.
That is Dean Spotis. I am Chris Ryan. This has been Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College.